Good morning. You're listening to The Coffee Table on KBBI AM 890. I'm Daisha Eaton, KBBI News Director, and we are talking farming, gardening, and more this morning. Most of the food we eat on the Kenai Peninsula is shipped in from somewhere else, but there is a local movement to produce more food in the region. You can call in and talk with our guests today about the local sustainable food movement on the Kenai Peninsula. We have Amy Seitz with the Alaska Farm Bureau, Brad Kassar with Homer Soil and Water, and Homer farmer Kyra Wagner, who's also with Sustainable Homer. She's right here in the studio with us. So welcome, Kyra.
Hello, thank you.
Hi. Kyra is, besides the list of things I mentioned earlier, she's a longtime local food advocate, a home gardening farmer. She's also the coordinator of Sustainable Homer, as I mentioned, which is a resource for local sustainability issues. She just started working as district manager for the Homer Soil and Water Conservation District, I believe yesterday, is that right?
That was my first day.
She also works with the Homer Farmers Market and the new online market, the Kenai Peninsula Food Hub. Welcome, Kyra.
Thank you.
Would you like to tell us a little bit about yourself in your own words?
Oh, my goodness. Well, I think you covered it. I'm very lucky to be in a community that cares so much and is so energized about food. We have a lot of people that are experimenting and moving forward in ways that we never dreamed of, with high tunnels and marketing and growing new kinds of things that have never really been experimented with here. So it's a very fun time to be here.
All right. And on the line, we also have Amy Seitz. She is a third-generation farmer on the Kenai Peninsula, still farming on her grandparents' homestead near Soldotna. She was hired as the executive director of the Alaska Farm Bureau in 2014. And the Farm Bureau is a nonprofit, nonpartisan organization that's dedicated to promoting and protecting Alaska's agriculture. Much of the focus for the Farm Bureau and for Amy is on policy issues, education, and outreach. Welcome, Amy.
Thank you for having me here today.
Yeah, and Amy, would you like to introduce yourself and tell a little bit more about
As you mentioned, I'm a third-generation farmer. Spent, all my life growing up on my grandparents' homestead, always involved in some sort of agriculture. Right now we focus on raising sheep for both fiber and meat, and then also chickens for meat and eggs, and expanding our garden every year. And then it was just kind of a natural jump for me to get into the Farm Bureau.
All right.
Agriculture from a policy side.
Yeah, and that's a lot of what you do, right, is you advocate in Juneau for farmers.
Juneau and, other board of game.
All right.
Other areas that affect agriculture.
And also on the line, we have Brad Kassar. He's the Natural Resource Specialist for Homer Soil and Water Conservation District. Kassar's office provides soil testing and nutrient recommendations, among other things. He works with the Natural Resource Conservation Service under the umbrella of the U.S. Department of Agriculture. Welcome, Brad.
Thank you.
And Brad, you want to tell a little bit more about what you do?
Sure. I'm fairly new to the agricultural scene here, just moved into the area a few years back, but just been involved with a lot of farmers, and recently been involved with Homer Soil and Water about a year ago, and just excited to continue on the movement for improving the agricultural scene around here and working with the district to continue their efforts.
All right. Thanks, Brad. And I'm going to start with Amy. Can you just give us like the 10,000-foot view of what farming looks like on the Kenai Peninsula? I know that I go by some, areas that look like maybe people are farming. I see some farmers markets around the area. What are people farming here on the Kenai Peninsula, Amy?
Oh, well, I would say a large variety of things. We have a growing fiber industry, natural fiber industry, sheep and goats and llamas and alpacas. We have, with the high tunnels going up all over the place, a lot of increase in the vegetable production. Several CSAs popping up seem to be very successful.
So there are lots of people doing animal husbandry, and they're you know, chickens and pigs mm-hmm. and some cattle, we know, and also people just growing vegetables on a home gardening basis, but also, you know, commercially, it sounds yeah. like, and fruit.
Yeah. And, our you know, up here and down there, the wineries.
Right. Can't forget the wine. So I'm going to ask all of you, kind of, if you're starting at zero and maybe you have some land, or, you know, let's say you have some land in a very in a lucky world, and you want to start gardening from zero on the Kenai Peninsula. I expect there are some people out there like that. Where do you start? You want to start, Kyra?
Sure.
You've done this.
I have done this. There are so many resources available for people to tap into. So really basic first thing is both the Central Peninsula and Homer have great garden clubs. So you can plug in. They have monthly meetings, and there's always presentations that are fascinating and educational, but you're also in a room with tons of other people who've been doing gardening and agriculture for who knows how long. Some of the best gardeners in the area are going to be there. So human resource number one, that's a great place to go. Also, as far as scientific information, Cooperative Extension Service has a myriad of handouts that you can get as far as how to grow tomatoes, how to grow potatoes, how to do a compost pile, how to, you know, all of those basic how-to pamphlets are available, as well as the Agricultural Extension Agency, Casey Matney. He's amazing and very active on the peninsula, as well as Janice Chumley, who is the Integrated Pest Management Specialist. So if you have any question about bugs that, you know, your first year something decimates your crop, she's the one that you want to talk to. So, and then the Soil and Water Conservation Districts on either end of the peninsula have resources as far as information. I'll let Brad talk about that, as well as equipment rentals, different things like that.
And now some of these are, there is a garden club here, mm-hmm. the Soil and Water Conservation District office is here in
yeah.
Homer,
mm-hmm.
right? But I think the extension office is in Kenai, is
it
that
is,
right?
That's yeah. true, yeah. So it comes, we get representation down here every once in a while. If you're going to pick up those pamphlets, it's easiest if you're in Soldotna to stop by their office. But the farmer's market often has those pamphlets available. They have a little file box, and you can often ask there to see if they have the files that you'd be interested in. A lot of their resources are around town, so you can have access to those, as well as classes. Casey's been coming down and doing soil classes, as well as, like, next week there's a fertilizer class at the college, how to fertilize your garden. You know, so that's a lot of one-on-one interaction you can have the option for.
And Amy, for you, what can the Alaska Farm Bureau do to help farmers who may be just starting out?
We try to connect people. You know, as Kyra mentioned, human resources out there is, you know, probably the most important thing. You know, talk to people who have experience. And each of our chapters around the state, people can go in and talk to other farmers in the area. And I would say one of the things people need to look at, especially if they're getting into a commercial or if they want to get into a commercial production, is figure out what market they're going after.
Right, for people who want to sell their
yeah.
products. So let's go to Brad. Now, your office does soil testing and all kinds of other things to help farmers out. Why would someone want to get their soil tested?
Yeah, that's a good question. And certainly it is one of the starting building blocks of understanding what you have to work with. So even though it can be a half a mile distance apart, soils can be dramatically different from place to place. So that'll kind of, you know, the soil testing is offered through the Homer District office, and you can bring soil samples by, and then the office I will be making recommendations if you're involved with contracts through Natural Resource Conservation Service. But also a great resource is the U.S. Geological Survey. which is Webb Soil Survey. And that's a good resource for understanding the basics about what suitabilities your soil and your land might have for agricultural production. But like Kyra mentioned, I think one of the biggest starting points is getting to know folks around the area and what they're doing and what is possible in your environment. So potentially you have neighbors that are farming as well, and getting to know what the difficulties or benefits of the area will be for climate and for your soils. But yeah, soil testing can be a great way for finding baseline data to get started.
And Brad, what are some of the characteristics of soil on the Kenai Peninsula? Does it vary a lot? Is it, you know, really the same from top to bottom?
There is a good amount of variation, but there are a lot of agricultural producers that work with a silt loam, and a loamy soil is preferable for a lot of agriculture. It's just a nice mix of sand, silt, and clay, the three primary minerals within soil, but we have very high organic matter in a lot of the soils around the peninsula, and that's due to just our cold climates not breaking down that organic matter. So that's a big benefit for a lot of growers, having a lot of organic matter to start with. But it is variable, and so especially if you're working with an area that may be wet seasonally, or if it's on a certain slope, you might have drainage issues or areas where it's more sandy. So getting to understand that and figuring out what plants prefer different areas is very important.
Thanks, Brad. Right now, I'm going to give out the telephone number for callers to go ahead and call in with their questions or comments for these gardening and farming experts we have online here for you. You're listening to The Coffee Table. We're talking about gardening and farming and the local sustainable food movement on the Kenai Peninsula. If you'd like to call locally, the number is 235-7221, and toll free it's 1-800-978-5224, and we'd love to have your calls. Now I want to go to Kyra and just talk a little bit, when we're talking about gardening here, home gardening versus gardening to sell. There's a big difference.
Yeah, and it's been interesting watching the high tunnel explosion here on the peninsula. When it first happened, the Homer Farmers Market kind of panicked that they were going to have so many farmers selling. But even though we have over 300 just in our district now, we haven't had that large of an increase in vendors. So it became apparent quite rapidly that people were growing for their own consumption, which is great, and there's nothing wrong with that. But you can grow a lot in a high tunnel, and now the high tunnel program allows you to have as many high tunnels as you want to apply for. So the opportunity to have any kind of commercial venture is much more open. So in that process, as Amy mentioned, identifying how you want to enter is definitely an issue. When people are home gardening, they often grow a myriad of different things, you know, because they're going to want to eat some broccoli here and some cauliflower there or whatever. But they wouldn't necessarily, that might not make the best business model. If you want to try and feed Two Sisters Bakery with as many onions as they can consume, then you have to grow a lot of onions, and you might just need to grow onions. You know, so that becomes more of a commercial venture. So then you have to do a little bit of analysis of what do people want and what would you be able to sell. We have, in my opinion, we definitely have more demand than production. So if you can find ways to meet that demand, you can sell vegetables here. We import so much food, and people would love to support local farmers. There has always been a great amount of enthusiasm here. So at least on my end of the peninsula, I can definitely say that if you grow it, you'll find a market for it. If you can, but it's preferable to find the market before you start growing, just to make sure that you can get rid of get all that stuff sold. But it definitely takes some planning.
All right. And I'm just going to make a correction because I just gave out an incorrect local telephone number. I want to make sure we get some callers for this interesting show. It's 235-7721. We're talking farming and gardening and local sustainable food here on the Kenai Peninsula. Give us a call with your questions and comments. That's 235-7721. And we already have a caller.
A question.
We have maybe a question about the extension service in Homer?
Since that's a very brief question, I'm just going to try and interpret that. The Cooperative Extension Service office, we only have one on the peninsula, and it is in Soldotna. We do have extension services down in Homer because the folks in the Kenai office often come down here or video conference their classes down here, and a lot of their materials are available down here and online. So they have a lot of a load as far as taking care of the whole entire Kenai Peninsula, but the office, central office, is located up in Kenai.
All right. And we do have a caller, Louise, on line two. Good morning, Louise.
Hi there.
Hi.
Hey, I just have a quick question for you. You mentioned applying for a high tunnel, and I was just wondering if that program that was subsidizing high tunnel purchase is still around.
That's a great question. What's going on with that? Does anyone know?
I could answer that. So could Brad. We both now technically work under the NRCS office. NRCS, Natural Resource Conservation Service under USDA, is still giving out those grants. It has morphed a great deal since the pilot program about 5 or 6 years ago. It is a solid program, nationally supported and funded. So it is reliable. You can go down there and put in your application. They'll ask you questions and have to make sure that you qualify. But yes, indeed, it is still open.
So what's the process? Let's just give them the nuts and bolts. Maybe Brad can jump in here. I know there's a lot of paperwork, right?
Yeah, so essentially you can come into the NRCS office and talk to them about whatever natural resource concern you may have going on. And the High Tunnel program is coming through a broader program called EQIP, and it is a cost-share incentives program, so not quite a grant, but it will essentially, you can stop into the office and talk to them about what you want to be involved with, maybe how large of a high tunnel, what your area is like, and it's important. There's a few factors to make sure you're eligible, which would be being in production in the area where you're planning to locate the high tunnel for at least a year, and so that can be a garden or a hay meadow or whatever it may be, and also just being agricultural producer for 5 years. So there's a few other caveats, but there is a good pile of paperwork, so that's always a fun one. And it goes on an annual cycle. So this year it will be April 15th, I believe, will be the deadline for applications for 2017 funding. Just to start your application and get that into NRCS by April 15th, and then you will be eligible for funding in the 2017 year to put up your high tunnel and start growing.
So, Brad, that deadline is right around the corner. You have to be a producer for 5 years to apply, though?
Well, so you have to be harvesting some sort of agricultural goods, and so that is fairly broad. It can be growing potatoes. Harvesting salmon is in that category for subsistence harvesting. So there are a few things you can talk to the folks at NRCS to see if you are eligible.
Okay. And I want to go over to Amy and just ask, we've been talking a lot about gardening and small farming, but let's talk about animal husbandry. You're familiar with that. What if somebody wants to get started raising pigs or cattle or one of, you know, goats or sheep?
Well, I'd definitely say look at the space you have available. If you have a swampy area, having animals in there may not be the best idea. And then also take a look at the feed. If you're not able to buy the hay and grain to take them through the winter, that's something you need to factor in. And then also definitely get to know other people who have animals around you. I mean, knowing what signs to look for if they get ill would be key. And maybe don't start out with a herd of 100. Yeah, so looking at some of these things would be the first steps in getting into animal care. Chickens are obviously the easiest animals to start out with, I would say. And a large growth in laying hens here on the peninsula and around the state, I would say.
And what are some of the animals that people are raising here on the peninsula?
Chickens, a lot of chickens for meat and eggs. Sheep and goats for fiber. We have a lot of people who just have a few sheep or a few goats, either to milk them or for their fiber. I think some people raise them for meat, you know, just for their own freezer. Pigs. I think down in Anchor Point in Homer, we just had a couple of pig operations start up in the last couple of years. Cattle down, I think, down in Homer and also a few up here. Llamas and alpacas. So a pretty wide variety. I mean, you can find almost all the basic livestock around here.
All right, and Kyra, what kinds of crops are people growing, you know, on small farms or commercially in Alaska? We all have heard of Alaska potatoes and Alaska carrots. We know those are popular and grown commercially. What else are people growing?
Right. Well, it's kind of like the animal issue. We have a little bit of everything. So, with the high tunnels, we now have the capacity to grow pretty much anything, minus bananas, nothing tropical. But we have fruit trees. We have, of course, all the cold crops. Like the reason carrots and potatoes are so popular is because they grow outside in cold weather, and high acid soils are fine. But now that we have high tunnels, we have people not just growing the cold crops like broccoli and cauliflower and greens, but also tomatoes and zucchinis and squashes and things like that that weren't necessarily that popular before. At the farmer's market, you can even get corn and pumpkins at times. So it has definitely broadened. Quantity of any one of those crops might not be as high, but we definitely have it all available here.
All right. And I just want to step back for a moment and just ask you, how did you get into this, Kyra, growing things?
Well, I grew up on a ranch in Colorado, and we always had a garden. So we always hunted, and we always had our own food. So it was always fairly basic for me. Then I, after college, went into the Peace Corps and worked in agriculture and worked in the tropics doing pretty much the same thing, promoting soil conservation and crop rotation and diversification. And then when I came to Alaska, just the awareness of our food insecurity issues, how far food comes from to feed us, made me all the more interested in keeping up that habit. And my husband is an avid gardener. He grew up on a truck farm for a farmer's market. His dad was the cornerstone in the Duluth, Minnesota farmer's market. So our household is full of greenery. And so that was fairly easy. What's been fun is connecting into the community level aspects of agriculture. And again, this is just a very exciting time and energized, enthusiastic population of people wanting to grow and experiment.
All right. And how long have you been in Alaska?
I came here in 2000.
Okay. And Amy, we already heard that you're a third generation farmer and that you're still farming on your grandparents' homestead. We know a little bit about you. Do you want to share anything else about how you got into what you do?
Well, I would say I was just born into it. I think the first lamb came onto the farm. My aunt was living here still when I was like 5 or 6. So I went right into 4-H doing lambs, and just kind of progressed to the flock we have now. So,
how large is your flock?
Well, right now we're down to about 35. We have 19 lambs that were just born, so I guess we're up to almost 55. But we're going through, we were at 65 a couple years ago. We're going through a culling process, so here pretty soon we'll start rebuilding.
Wow, sounds like you've been busy.
Lambing season is fun, but you know, don't get a lot of sleep.
And Brad, how did you get into soil?
Yeah, well, first I wanted to jump back to what was growing on the peninsula. I just wanted to add a couple things, but hay production is pretty big throughout the peninsula, and there are so many people raising animals that need hay. Also, rhodiola and peonies are in fairly big production, and they both have cooperatives that you can become involved with if you're interested in growing those two crops. And but personally, I jumped into soil, I suppose, 6 or 7 years ago. I just kind of had an interest in agriculture, and I didn't realize it was soils at first, but I guess I got a little nerdy and enjoyed the soil life. So I've just been working in a really wide variety of agricultural positions for the past 6 or 7 years, and really enjoyed it.
And how long have you been in Alaska and in Homer?
Just a few years.
Okay. Yeah. And I want to go back to what you were saying. So people are growing hay to feed their animals. And then you talked about, I think, flowers that we can't eat, which are very beautiful, though. So what were you talking about? What kinds of flowers?
Yeah, so peonies are a flower that are primarily used in wedding ceremonies. But the market that Alaska can access is different than a lot of the world, so we end up being a shipper globally for people that want to access these flowers at a certain time of the year. The climate has been changing in the past few years, so that has been altering the harvest date, but that is a global market that I'm not sure how long the cooperative has been going on. Rita Jo Schultz is heading, I believe, the cooperative here in Homer, and it's a fairly large industry. Rhodiola is a little bit less so. It's newer on the front, I suppose, but it also has a cooperative, and Homer Soil and Water is involved with Al Poindexter and some of the growers that now have some equipment to utilize and process the rhodiola on the peninsula, and that will be also likely a export product, producing a herbal tea, I believe, or possibly in supplement form for medicinal purposes. But agriculture certainly does go on beyond food and raising animals. Just was there a couple of them that we hit here on the peninsula?
All right. Thanks, Brad. And I'm going to give out the number again for people who'd like to chime in on this conversation about the local sustainable food movement, farming, growing flowers, animal husbandry, whatever you'd like to talk about here concerning farming and gardening, etc. The number here at KBBI is 235-7721. You can also call toll-free at 1-800-978-5222. And we'd love to have your questions or comments here for the coffee table. I'm going to go back to Kyra. I wanted to ask you, I know you know about some local indigenous plants here, and I think you grow some yourself in your garden, and my goodness, they're growing all around us. I can see the plants coming up in my yard that are here already. What about gardening with local plants, with some of these indigenous plants that have high nutritional value, medicinal value? Are people doing that?
I don't know that people are necessarily intentionally doing it that much, but there is a lot of harvest. So it's a sort of thing when somebody has a nettle patch, for example, they're going to nurture that nettle patch and make sure that they get as many harvests of nettle off of there. Is that a... a conscious gardening aspect, maybe not. It is impressive to me how many people eat things like the seasonal nettles and the seasonal fireweed shoots and twisted stalk shoots and things like that. And people who have mushroom patches that they have identified that they know that they can go harvest at. Some of those have gone a little bit commercial. There are folks at the farmers market who have in the past sold mushrooms and nettles. But as far as most of the native plants go, a lot of that is just strictly home use. There are a lot of things that are non-traditional that are, for example, herbs and things that grow in high tunnels that people are starting to grow more. So you're seeing a lot more of the what would be wildcrafting in the lower 48 is actually gardening here. So things like the different kinds of mints and the exotic herbs that can be done. So there's a little bit of experimentation in all of that.
I notice when I go on to like the Homer Classifieds and some of these local Facebook sites, people are sometimes selling things that grow here. Like one thing I've seen a lot is the chaga, I think it's called.
Right.
And I'm just wondering about that wild crafting. Are any of these organizations working on guidelines to help make sure that things like chaga don't disappear from Alaska?
Mm.
Are they talking to local indigenous people about how some of these plants might be used and what the guidelines are for harvesting them? Because I see people and I'm like, oh, wow, this person has like 25 pounds of chaga. That's a lot of chaga. And if you read about chaga, it takes a long time for it to develop, right?
Right.
And so, yeah, Alaska's big. We think we have these, you know, unending resources of plants and other things. But they could be harmed by this too, right? So are any of your offices working on that, any of that?
That's a good question. I haven't actually seen much of that. I have seen Cooperative Extension putting together things about morels and things like that, mostly focused on education to make sure that people are being safe about it, food safety issues. As far as harvest, since it hasn't become a large commercial crop, I haven't seen anything. Maybe one of your other two guests have a better idea of that. But often I see a culture of harvesters created. So for example, like with chaga, a lot of the people I've talked to, this isn't a rule, but people who have learned to harvest chaga from somebody who used to, you know, some older person who did it when they were a kid, and they show them how to harvest, they often show them how to leave a portion of the fungus attached to the tree, so you don't just strip it completely, and it's embedded in the tree, so it will eventually come back. But that's a good question. I don't know if that's been measured or monitored.
But there are ethical guidelines for wildcrafting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and as far as I can say, it's only been culturally handed down.
Okay. Anybody else want to weigh in on that, Amy or Brad? Radio silence.
I would certainly agree with Kyra that it is culturally passed down from one harvester to the next, and I don't believe there's much regulation particularly going on with much wild edibles, and it is mostly for home consumption, but there, you're right, there is a growing market for different wild edibles like chaga, but maybe as the demand increases or the harvesting increases, then certain regulatory agencies might become involved with those.
Okay. And Brad, you alluded to this earlier, that the climate is changing, which I think many of us are aware, and certainly people who've lived here for a long time are noticing. What does climate change mean for agriculture in this area? Who wants to go first?
Sure. I'll jump into that. I suppose climate change is always changing, so we can't really tell where it's headed, but certainly the past 3 years, we've got some warm, seasonally warm springs and falls and summer temperatures, so if you happen to be lucky in trying to plant crops that are thriving in warmer temperatures, then you can utilize that. But at the same time, less rainfall. So not being able to rely on rainfall and maybe having to install irrigation systems for farms that have never had that issue in the past because we've had some dry summers. So it's more adapting to the constant change and trying to figure out how to make your system hardy enough to handle whatever there is to come. But I'm not aware of any predictions or specifically what the change will be, but we just adapt as it comes along, I suppose.
And Kyra?
Yeah, one of the things that I've had people ask me about is zones. You know, like it's USDA now calls Homer Zone 6, whereas it used to be a Zone 3 or 4. So things are shifting. One of the things to take into consideration when experimenting with all of those warm weather crops is that there is a risk involved. We still are in a northern latitude, and we still can get freezes in April or May or even as early as or as late as June. So that is the risk that comes in. So that is the exciting and exhilarating part of gardening right now is the adaptive process of planting early and seeing what survives, but also being ready for that fluke storm that comes at the end of May.
And how about with raising animals, Amy? Is climate change having an effect there? Are people thinking about that?
Well, with it being so warm, one of the changes we've seen is shearing is happening earlier. The sheep naturally start to kind of shed their wool when it starts to get pretty warm, so I've seen shearing happening earlier just to get the nicer fleeces. Obviously, for me, it makes lambing season a lot nicer, not going out there at 30 below in January and February. But the lack of snow cover has been kind of, and similar to the lack of rain, you know, you want that snow cover to protect the roots and also provide a little more water for the pasture in the spring. So although it's nice having warmer temperatures, there's some issues that have to be worked through, either putting in irrigation, or I think I've been watering the pasture more the last couple of years than I have ever in the past. So definitely a good and bad, or good and challenging side of it.
Amy, I was wondering if you could also touch on some of the policy issues that you've been working on.
Yeah, because there have been quite a few this year, and actually the last couple of years, that affect agriculture, not just on the peninsula, but statewide. Mount McKinley Meat and Sausage is the only USDA slaughter facility in South Central, and for 90% of the markets, people would need a USDA stamp for their red meat or white meat if you're growing pigs. So that's been an issue that is always up in the air. It's in the budget, so the legislature has to approve it every year. And the last couple of years, they put a one-time increment funding on it, which means if they didn't approve it this year, it would be closed down June 30th. So that's been a big push for the Farm Bureau, is to keep that in the budget another year while looking at transitioning into a private operator. One of the reasons is to have a long-term commitment to keep it open. It's hard to increase your animals if you don't know if the slaughter facility is going to be around from year to year. Another one of the big issues is, I think people have been hearing about it, but the Board of Game proposal that would remove sheep and goats from the clean list and put some other big restrictions if you live, you know, within a certain distance from Dall sheep habitat. And that's been one that came up for us the end of January or beginning of February. I was made aware of it. Which the Board of Game didn't pass that proposal. They gave us 2 years to work with the various agencies that should be involved in the discussion. So we're hopeful something good will, you know, we're hopeful the sheep and goats will not be harmed, that industry.
And Amy, what's the concern there?
Well, the concern is the spread of disease. Down in the States, there has been some issues happening. Depending on which study you read, it's not just a cut-and-dried contact with domestic sheep, so there's a lot of questions that haven't been answered. Up here in Alaska, we haven't had a problem with it. We don't have large numbers of sheep and goat. We don't have the large grazing leases out in doll sheep habitat, so we're quite a bit different than other states. You know, all of our animals are fenced in already, so the potential for contact between the two is already low. The proposal that was put forth was pretty extreme to solve a problem that we're not having yet. We obviously want to make sure we don't have a problem, but I think right now the potential is very low.
And what about this other issue you're working on to promote buying local?
Yeah, and I think a couple years ago, Representative Tarr kind of picked it up, the Alaska Product Preference Program. And I think there's five different categories. One of them is agriculture and fish. And when the state institutions go out to, you know, put out their bids for groceries or dairy or meat, or, you know, they're supposed to give Alaska products a preference. For agriculture, it's a 7% preference. And they're supposed to give Alaska bitters, I think it's a 10% preference. So just trying to get the state to use that more. And like one of the things we're looking at is when the state puts out a bid to a wholesaler, they should have some pretty strong incentives for that wholesaler to buy Alaska potatoes or carrots or, you know, items like that. So we're just trying to, it's already in the statutes, it's already law, we just want to get it used more. And that would be a huge potential for growing commercially our agriculture products.
Okay, thanks, Amy. I want to go back to Kyra and Brad, and just talk a little bit about some of the resources that are available for people beyond soil testing at your office with the water Soil and Water Conservation District, because you also help with things like pest management. Can you talk about some of those other resources? Who'd like to go first? Brad, how about you?
Yeah, sure. So the district has been around, I believe, since about 54. We have worked with farmers and ranchers in the area to help with conservation practices over the years, and kind of always trying to improve practices and alter practices for managing the land for its suitabilities. So, more recently, we're involved with making nutrient recommendations for farmers. So bringing soil tests in, letting them know, or having a discussion for what they grow, how they want to fertilize, and how they want to manage their soils, and we can provide recommendations for those. And more so NRCS, Natural Resource Conservation Service, who provides the programs for the high tunnels and other practices. They can provide technical assistance, and as can I, for different practices like cover cropping or crop rotation and pest management. A lot of the primary practices that are used in agriculture, and just promote sustainable conservation practices. So stopping in the office and just chatting about maybe you have new land coming into production, or you have a hay field that is under production and you're trying to figure out how to improve the soil or improve the plant health. The office there has great staff that's been around for quite some time with a lot of local knowledge, so can definitely provide a lot of technical assistance there.
I suspect your phone will be ringing off the hook soon, Brad. I want to go to line two. We have Dennis.
Hello.
Hi, Dennis.
I have been listening to you, and something that finally perked me to call in, but I'll start at the beginning. We've gardened here for 40 years, and tried small agriculture, and it's just been the recent boon of the high tunnels that have made a good light on the horizon that small agriculture can go here, and you can see that by the growth and expansion of the farmer's market. And we've got a tunnel. Actually, we chopped it into two. One of them we have, we're growing small fruit trees and bushes that aren't zone applicable at our elevation. We're at 2,500. And it's just been great, you know. The program for the high tunnels through NRCS is incredible thing that has happened to our area. But the thing that perked me was the thing about the Board of Game and that Title 90 that you were talking about the goats and sheep. That had me pretty excited, and so I did quite a bit of calling around. And the state vet informed me that situation is basically a moot point, and there's just been a paper introduced that should, you know, collapse that whole thing. First off, the proposal was put in by the Foundation for North American Wild Sheep, which is an organization, but it kind of irks me that they're trying to control Alaska or attempting to control things going on in Alaska. But the viruses and stuff that is affecting the sheep in the South 48, there's been a study done now that even those indigenous sheep that lie away, a long way away from where domestic sheep and goats are at, still have the stuff in their bloodstream. So it's been there before domestic sheep were introduced into the regions. And that is something that agriculturalists that are worried about this thing should get a hold of that paper and use it as ammunition to just totally blow that proposal out of the water, even in 2 years. But it's fantastic that the high tunnel situation has come up, and there's actually a bright light on the horizon for agriculture here.
All right. Thanks, Dennis.
It's always been a problem with the state. You know, you were talking about the slaughterhouse. You need to get on the horn and talk to your legislators about funding agriculture. Make sure that, you know, granted, we are on hard times. There's no doubt about it. But there's certain entities that shouldn't be wrung out of the money stream, even if it's just part of what they got, just to keep it in the picture, and that's agricultural sciences, the slaughterhouse, and that sort of thing. So make your voices heard.
Okay, thanks, Dennis. Amy, did you want to chime in on any of what Dennis had to say?
Yeah, on the sheep and goat issue, you know, he brought up one of the studies, and I think I mentioned that there's so many unanswered questions. There's two bacteria of concern. And even within those two bacteria, one of them has a leukocyte positive and a leukocyte negative. And yes, one of them is endemic in both both wild and domestic, but it's the leukocyte positive strain that's of concern. So, I mean, there's still so many unanswered questions, and even talking to wild sheep microbiologists, they say, you know, they don't even have all the answers. Questions on other stressors involved, not just contact with domestic sheep and goats. You know, down in the States, there's human development that's eating up wild sheep habitat, and that's a stressor. You know, so there's so many factors involved. One of the other things that it's a moot point, and yes, I would agree, the Board of Game proposal is a moot point. Fish and Game doesn't have the authority to manage livestock. Our issue, I guess, is the Wild Sheep Foundation is going to approach it from another way, you know, if once the Prop 90 fails, or if it fails, once that's no longer an issue, they're going to look at legislation or something else. So we're just trying to stop it before it gets to that point by having a plan that doesn't hurt the domestic side of things.
Sounds like this conversation will probably continue.
Yes, it will. And we finally have the agencies that should be at the table discussing and talking. We have our state vet and Fish and Game and the Division of Ag. And we'll be bringing in mining land and water. So we finally have the people at the table that should be there to discuss the plan. But it's just, you know, we just started since we weren't brought into the loop until recently. So we at least have the right people at the table to look at it. And I do want to reiterate, he mentioned contacting legislators for the budget, and that is key. Division of Ag was hit pretty hard, or potentially hit pretty hard. They were looking at removing the potato program from the Plant Materials Center, and that is a big issue. You know, that's potatoes being one of our important crops, one of our top five crops in the state. If we lost our seed potato program, it would hurt us pretty bad. So definitely contact legislators and let them know that agriculture is important and the Division of Ag funding is important.
Okay. We have Shelly on line three. Hi, Shelly.
I just wanted to call to say thank you to Kyra for all of her hard work. It's been amazing what's happened with our local farmer market. Yeah, and it's kind of exciting to see this renaissance nationwide, but particularly here in Homer, and all the enthusiasm in the younger generation. And thanks to Mark Kenny, who helped kick off bringing so many high tunnels into Homer, and the crew that's kept it going. It's just been pretty phenomenal. And on that, I wanted to add a little comment about an earlier caller, just to clarify some on the Peony Co-op. It's Alaska Beauty Peony Co-op, if anybody wants to look it up. And he mentioned Rita Joe. She's part of a marketing collaborative. And then another entity involved is Alaska Peony Growers. That's a trade association that supports the industry. So I just wanted to put that bit of information out there if anybody's interested. So anyway, that's all I wanted to say. I just want to say thanks to everybody who's made an incredible thing happen.
Okay. Thanks, Shelley.
Yeah.
I want to turn to the future of agriculture on the Kenai Peninsula, since we're heading toward the top of the hour here. We're almost through with this program. There is a lot going on. A lot has happened recently, and there are some new developments. One of them, this farmers market has grown a lot locally. The actual farmers market here in Homer has grown a lot. And also there's this new thing called the Food Hub. I did a story about it a couple weeks ago. Cook Inlet Keeper is part of that. Do you want to talk about that, Kyra? You're involved with that too, right?
Yeah. Yeah. So as far as the future of agriculture on the peninsula, I would definitely say that we have the way we're doing things now, as Dennis mentioned, we have small-scale agriculture. We do not have large fields and combines and, you know, large-scale agriculture. But all of these small, diversified crops are an excellent adaptive food resource. And the Food Hub is another way that people could sell their food. It's an online food hub. It's coming into development. It should hit the net by May. The idea is that you would, as a producer, you would be able to post what availability you have, what your vegetables are, and then each week and certain days of that week, people can go on and check what's available and order. So as a consumer, you could go on there and put in the word strawberries and see who's selling strawberries. Maybe you're a restaurant and you need 50 pounds of carrots, and no particular farmer has 50 pounds of carrots, but there's several that have 5 or 10. And so you could amalgamate an order to get what you need. So we're hoping that will fit a new and another niche of getting food to the consumer with our small scale and diversified agriculture that we have here.
And that's run by Cook Inlet Keeper. They're hosting mm-hmm. that website.
Right. This is a first off kind of experiment. We've surveyed a lot of vendors. We think this is definitely a strong possibility of being very elemental in our food system here, but we got a grant for 2 years to do a kickoff. So Cookin' the Keeper is hosting that kickoff. When the grant is over, though, it's going to have to fly on its own. So we are putting as much time and attention into it right now to make sure that it gets a good, strong start and can keep going once we have our independence.
And also, it sounds like they're going to try to have some seafood on this food hub. And I think there is the possibility, perhaps in the future, there are some guidelines and hoops to jump through for there to be a locally grown meat on this site, too.
Oh, right, right. Yeah, so seafoods would be great. We'd love to have that option. One of the people that's on our little committee right now is the oyster growers. So any of those seafoods that we can get on there, we would love to have access to salmon, accessible and easy. We're working with Alaska Marine Conservation Council and Hannah Heimbach on trying to get that coordinated because it's a different venue. It might not work as well for fishermen, but we're hoping it will. And meats, as the issue of the USDA slaughter facility, is huge. You can't legally sell meat in packets like you get in this grocery store unless it's gone through a USDA facility. So figuring out how we can work with that, as well as things like breads and home baked goods. Right now, you can sell those without a DEC-approved kitchen if you're selling it directly from producer to consumer. We have to get the state to understand that if there's an online portal, it's still direct to consumer. It's a new area of expertise.
And these food hubs, this is a national movement. These mm-hmm. are popping up all over the country, right?
Yeah, yeah. The person who's managing this program is Robbie Mixon, who is also the manager at the Homer Farmers Market. She's got her pulse on all things food right now, and she just got out of a conference in Atlanta about food hubs. So it's definitely a large-scale movement across the country.
Well, we're down to our last few minutes on the coffee table here, talking about farming and local agriculture on the Kenai Peninsula. I just want to give you a quick chance to just chime in with any last thoughts, Kyra.
I think we're covering a lot of ground here, but hopefully everybody's jotted down all the resources where they can ask more questions.
And Amy, you want to chime in real quick, too?
I'm excited to see agriculture continue to grow here. Excited about the online food hub that Kyra was talking about, to see the farmers working together to produce the quantity for these larger markets like restaurants. So it's really exciting this time.
And Brad.
Yeah, I would just say as the agricultural community continues to grow that there's going to be new markets popping up like the food hub, and we need to keep searching out new venues for getting food to the folks that need it. And it's exciting to see what's on the horizon.
All right. This has been the Coffee Table on KBBI AM 890. Thanks for joining us, Kyra Wagner, Brad Kassar, and Amy Seitz.